Welcome to The Geek in Review, the podcast focused on innovative and creative ideas in the legal profession. I'm Marlene Gebauer.
And I'm Greg Labbers. So Marlene, this is our five-year podcast anniversary.
Happy anniversary.
This month in June. Yay. So I just didn't want that to go pass us by without saying something, because I think it's been, you know, just a fantastic 5 years.
Agreed.
And, you know, it really feels like this year we've almost started anew with all the generative AI and advancements in technology that's been going on this year.
It's true. I mean, we've always had great interviews, but this is sort of a whole new area that is new to everybody. And so I think that makes it even more exciting.
It's been fun because at work, I sound like the expert. So
it's like everybody's an expert
I'll take it.
You know, and as you noted, Greg, we have had a lot of episodes devoted to generative AI tools, you know, what they can do, how to address risk in using them. Today, though, we're delving into a darker area, one where AI is used to purposely fool the viewer and impact decision making in court. So welcome to the world of deepfakes in a court near you. Are we ready? Say yes.
Oh, yes.
Our guest today has been speculating on that question. Isha Marate, a legal tech reporter for American Lawyer Media, recently wrote an article, "Deepfakes Are Coming to a Court. Are Judges and Lawyers Ready?" where she delves into the implications on litigation. Isha, welcome to The Geek in Review.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited. I'm excited to talk about this.
Yeah, we are too.
It's scary, but it's interesting. Yeah.
Both.
Yeah. Scary or interesting.
This is our ghost story episode. So I'll see if I can get some scary music to underlay it. So, well, Isha, before we kind of dive into the article, let's back up a little bit and just talk about, you know, what exactly is a deep fake? And I know that I think we've seen a lot of these on, social media, and we probably heard of some other darker recesses of the web that these have shown up. But can you kind of just give us an overview of it?
Yeah. So a deepfake, I mean, it's like in the word, it's just a blend of deep and fake. And the deep comes from deep learning, which is a form of machine learning. So that's like the AI bit of it. And then the fake is more obvious. It's comes from the fact that this technology is used to create an image, which usually incorporates the likeness of another person. And it does so like in a really convincing and a really good way. So I really see a deep fake as like a really, really good, super realistic Photoshop situation.
How are they created? I'm very curious to know that, because you mentioned this is a really, really good Photoshop. And, you know, like I'll show my kids pictures and they can tell me right away. It's like, oh, that's been shopped. And I can't tell, but they can tell. But apparently these are so good that even maybe they can't tell. So like, how are they created?
They are. They're really good and they're getting better. I almost want to say like every 2 weeks.
Oh, my gosh.
Like I know only like 2 months ago, they couldn't really create hands too well, or there were like too many teeth in people's mouths. And like now they're like, wait, the hands look great and the teeth look great. So they're really good Photoshop situation. I shouldn't even say Photoshop. I just say that because that's the only kind of barometer to equate it with.
Yeah.
But they're made very differently. It's not a cut and paste situation. There's many ways of actually making deepfakes. And back in the day, and by that I mean pre the democratization of generative AI, which has happened over the past few months, pre that era, there was this like kind of complicated and expensive and lengthy process where you needed high-end computers, you know, which allowed you had to use like an encoder-decoder algorithm where two people's faces were run through two encoder-decoder pairs. The encoders kind of learned the latent facial features of these people during the training. And then at the end of the process, the decoders were swapped so that the image kind of was decoded to produce the facial features of the other person. And this was like, sounds complicated. It was complicated. And it took so long because you had to repeat this process over and over, like hundreds of times for each frame of a video or to train the algorithm sufficiently, you know, to create a believable image or deepfake. And that's just one example. There's like, there were tons of ways to make these kind of time-consuming and complex deepfakes. But that, of course, changed after we kind of, OpenAI came on the scene with, you know, the first tool was ChatGPT, which doesn't create a deepfake, but it kind of democratized generative AI, as I said. So now we have like Stability AI and Midjourney, and Midjourney is famous / infamous for the Pope in the puffer jacket deepfake.
I thought it was real.
Which we all loved it. You know, it's like, that's the thing.
Yeah. No, it's so great. And, you know, there's Lensa, which we saw, I think it was like on everyone's Instagram story at one point, and it kind of like looked cool, and, you know, it looked just like people's faces, and there were all these cool backgrounds that looked realistic. And anyway, like this thing that's kind of just like memeified and like made fun and viral has kind of changed this lengthy, expensive process that needed a lot of skill and good equipment into something that a beginner can now do just by clicking a button. You can create these super realistic images. You can feed a text prompt, which is what I think the Pope in the puffer jacket situation was, or you can feed images into some of these tools, and the software can be found super easily. It's on GitHub, which is an open source development community. So it's really approaching a click of a button technology.
So,
you know,
so much easier than it used to be.
So much easier. It really is.
Easier.
So, you know, we're talking about the Pope and the puffer, and, you know, that was fun and amusing. And everyone had a laugh. But, you know, the Pope and a puffer aside, say that quickly. Why, you know, you reported that deepfakes, you know, are sort of creeping into litigation. And, you know, why are deepfakes so dangerous in that context?
So there are really two ways for deepfakes to come into litigation as of right now. And one of them is a deepfake at the center of a case. Say it's a defamation case. Say the Pope was like, I didn't like that, you know, or like whatever. But the other, which I think right now to me is scarier, is a deepfake coming in as evidence for a case that has nothing to do with a deepfake. And that second possibility is the one that we talked a lot about with our really great sources for that piece that you're talking about. And I think that it poses the most challenges right now, because without the education, without the technology, and without the regulations in place to tackle this technology that is really evolving at breakneck speed and is suddenly like in the hands of everyone, the legal system doesn't have too many ways to stop it, to understand it, from entering trials and courtrooms and even coming in front of a jury, which is the most scary. And I'm sure, you know, we'll get into that part more later, but it's really a challenge to deal with evidence that just is not what it looks like or sounds like upon first instance. And I think to me, this really, like, this technology really drags the legal industry into like a similar post-truth era that we found politics to be in 2015, 2016.
Yay.
That's scary to me.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of wondering, it's like, you know, are people who deal with evidence, are they ready for this? Are they aware of this? And how are they going to deal with it?
Okay, so there's many people who could technically deal with it. There's like different...
Yeah, maybe we should start with like who deals with it. Maybe just sort of answer that question.
Right.
And we can go into sort of what to do later.
The very first line of defense, according to our reporting so far, has been that it would be e-discovery professionals, because not only are they likely to be the first ones to catch something amiss, but they also probably have the most tech education. My colleague, Cassandra Coyer, who's also on the tech desk, actually wrote a really great piece about the three lines of defense that e-discovery professionals have right now when it comes to tackling deepfakes. And, you know, they go, the first line is the metadata, which may give e-discovery folks enough information even before review, just by kind of trying to track the life cycle of how the data has been flowing that's connected to an image that may be a deepfake or not. And the second line of defense is the forensics, which is actually analyzing the image, running it through software, or doing a semantics analysis. And then the third line of defense is the one that's like the most forward-looking, and I think extends beyond legal, which is waiting for good tools to come to market that are going to detect AI generated output. So yeah, that's the e-discovery portion of it, I think.
Yeah. Are you seeing any examples that are already entering the court, and are there particular types of cases that are more, I guess, vulnerable to this?
So I think that, you know, we've seen two as of late May in terms of where a party said that or claimed that the evidence that was presented was a deepfake. And one was in a Tesla lawsuit involving an image of Elon Musk. And another one was related to the Jan 6 riots involving former President Barack Obama and
Trump.
Oh, sorry. Involving former President Donald Trump. And both judges determined that the evidence was, in fact, a deepfake. And it came up and it kind of went, and it didn't cause too much of an effect on the case itself. So we haven't seen anything that so far has like altered a case dramatically. But for people who've talked to, they're like, even these two cases are enough to signal something in the pipeline.
So, you know, you quite rightly mentioned that, you know, e-discovery folks are sort of the first line of defense in order to identify deep fakes. Are there any others, you know, before things get to court? And then once it gets to court, you know, how do they make this determination? And, you know, how successful, you know, are these methods to try and shine the light on deep fakes?
So, a lot of the questions around how successful the methods
do we
are,
even know
it's just early days for that, and I wish I knew, but yeah, it is early days for that. But you know, to me, it's kind of a lot of it falls on counsel and them being educated enough to inform the bench about the technology that's coming in. And Lee Tydrick, who I actually interviewed for the article, she does workshops with judges where she has, I believe, like monthly sessions to just educate them about the basics of this technology. So the education part kind of falls on everyone. But right now, if we're talking before even coming into court, I think e-discovery experts would be like the key player here.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they've been the key player for, you know, fake documents or documents that have been altered. So it would make sense. But I know Professor Tedrich had talked about the amount of education that the judiciary needs for this. But, you know, I'm hoping that it doesn't cost any money, because the courts don't have any money. So how, I mean, is education going to be enough, I guess?
No.
No, it's not. And it's not going to be free.
And, you know, it's not going to be consistent and equitable. I remember when I started reporting on law and tech, and a source said to me, if you know one court, you know one court. And that's just, like, super true. So I think that's going to be very true here. You know, we saw over the pandemic that there were some courts who were super prepared. You know, they already had cloud integrations and video conferencing technology, and their judges knew how to use Zoom. And then there were other folks who were like taping cameras to the ceiling, trying to do just like some type of a video conferencing situation. And I think that's how this is going to be. You know, the tech that's coming up to detect AI generated images is super new. The education is super sparse right now, because, you know, who even knows what's going on, including the people who are making the technology. So, yeah, it's kind of, I wish I had a better answer for that other than no, it's just going to be rough.
Yeah, I mean, because I know Professor Tydrick was mentioning that, you know, judges should have, you know, trusted technical experts on ham who can authenticate. And as, you know, Greg very rightly pointed out, you know, the courts don't have financial or administrative resources to hire these experts. And I wonder how we're going to deal with it. Well,
yeah.
Well, I think Isha already said we're not.
We're not.
Yeah.
I know. I'm just hoping that there's another answer. Yeah.
I don't know that like all hope is lost. I don't mean to say that. I just think in terms of the education, I just think it'll be slow. But there are tools in the toolkit currently, even for judges. And you know, one of the tools that comes up often is the Federal Rules of Evidence series 901 and 902, which gives the court a rubric for dealing with computer generated evidence. So there are things in there, you know, there are little pieces that judges can rely on. And some people, you know, who we spoke to believe that that's enough. And they believe that a widget is a widget, to quote one of my sources. And it shouldn't make a difference if it's a deep fake or if it's a text message or a Slack message or an emoji, you know, it's all at the end of the day, the same. There are people who believe that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So there are these rules.
Going back to sort of how this is going to impact the courts, you know, what about the existing backlog? Will having to deal with the deepfakes further delay litigation? And, you know, how much more pressure will litigants have to settle or arbitrate or mitigate?
I personally do not know about the effect on settlements. And I wonder, again, if that is, there's not been enough cases to know yet. However, it is super likely that deepfakes will complicate litigation. And, you know, it'll just, because of the situation where there's a lack of education, a lack of blanket comprehensive education around this technology, and also a lack of technical experts for judges, you know, what is going to happen is that both parties just have their own experts if they can afford them. And they're going to be expensive, which brings up a lot of access to justice issues. But it's going to be expensive, and it's going to lead to what folks call battle of experts, where there's just an image of person A meeting person B. One party says that image is fake, and you know, without universal watermarking standards and without a court that's equipped to handle the situation, each side is just going to bring its own expert and they're just going to duel it out in this confusing and expensive battle of experts. That's what I think.
Well, and obviously, you know, if someone purposefully sends in fake evidence to a case, that there would be repercussions for that if caught. Mm-hmm. And so, mm-hmm. it's a very high risky move to make. Do you know, I know Mr. Schwartz from New York just got fined $5,000. Have you seen any kind of actions or sanctions so far? Because like the courts just came out with new rules on, you've got to tell us if you're using generative AI. Mm-hmm. Has anyone jumped on this about, do you have to verify that these are not deep fakes?
I do not know of courts or judges specifically who have said this yet, from the reporting that I've done until the end of May, but I believe there are regulations coming out of Texas, Washington, and California. The California law might actually have sunsetted, earlier this year, but, there are state laws coming up kind of like data privacy regulations, which we often call a patchwork because they're slightly conflicting. And you know, in the absence of federal regulations, of course, that's what we have. So I think that's what we have right now when it comes to any authentication compliance for AI image generators, but nothing I know of for a court in particular.
So if a deep fake does get past safeguards, you know, if it gets in front of a jury, you know, even if it's discovered and stricken, you know, what sort of impact do you think that has? You know, do you think jurors can just walk away from what they've already seen? I mean, images can be very compelling.
Yeah, there's really kind of a debate here among our sources for the story about deepfakes in court, at least. And half of the folks who we talked to say, well, a jury is almost like sacrosanct in a way where you can't even question. They're just a cog in the machine and we just have to trust what they're doing. And that's just how it's always been. And you can't really get into their psychology too much here around deepfakes. But then there's others, and this is a part that I'm more interested in, who say that a jury, at the end of the day, is just a set of people, and shaking off that first impression of an image or a video just because a judge says, oh, disregard that, you know, it's not really realistic. And taking that a step further, if either side is then dissatisfied about the jury's ability to unwind their knee-jerk presumptions about a fake image or video, it could lead to calls for mistrials, again, lengthy legal battles. So I do think, you know, the potential to influence a jury here is really alarming.
So Isha, we've talked about, you know, the Pope and the puffer jacket and really kind of images that are being used as, or deepfakes are being submitted as evidence, but there's other types of evidence that could also be manipulated through mm-hmm. this, such as video recordings that are introduced, or even witness testimony or transcripts. So, you know, what steps do you think can be done on these things as well?
I really think that starting education early, and I know that's always like an easy, just like an easy thing to say because you can't really touch it. It's not so tangible. But I do think starting education early for judges, you know, having mandatory kind of education courses or CLE credits around this is the way to go. Not just for judges, but for counsel, for e-discovery professionals as well, you know, just flagging that, hey, like, this is coming. We might see things, we might hear things that aren't what they seem to be. And just keep that in mind. Aside from technology,
That was good.
For courts to incorporate.
That's what I was going to ask, is if, do you think the technology, for example, we've talked about people using AI and submitting AI for classwork, for homework, I imagine being used for trials as well. But, you know, there's systems out there that supposedly you can paste something in and it can tell you, you know, this is probably 80% chance written by AI. Is the technology to catch deepfakes at least kind of keeping a close runner-up to the advancements in creating the deepfakes?
Yeah, that's really a good question that I don't know the answer to. I've heard both things. I've heard things, you know, folks saying, no, there's a lot of interest to create this technology. And then I've heard folks saying that it's really, there's not enough money being put there.
That's not what people want to spend their money on, right?
That's right. And I don't know, like, honestly, which side is true. But I think there are solutions, certainly. There's Sensity, Maltego, ZeroFox, among several solutions that claim to be able to identify a deepfake. But until there are enough of them and until there's enough kind of causes to do this analysis, I think it's going to be hard to say. Though a lot of what I know is just experts kind of looking at an image and then saying, like, there was most recently that video that Florida Governor Ron DeSantis posted of, or his campaign, I apologize, on Twitter posted of, it was like a mishmash of pictures of Donald Trump. And one of the pictures was Donald Trump hugging Dr. Fauci. And, you know, that one has since been kind of debunked as a deep fake. But then experts came out and they said, oh, his collar doesn't line up and his buttons are a bit weird and his like neck doesn't look real. But on first instance, it kind of looks real.
Yeah.
And that's really the concern, right? Like, it's, you know, by the point people see it, it's already too late. And that's really the concern with the technology.
Yeah. And I keep going back to this idea of like how it's going to impact the credibility of evidence. And, you know, is this going to force a change in sort of the rules of evidence? You know, how how does this proliferation of deep fakes, you know, how is that going to impact burden of proof for legal professionals and standards of admissibility for evidence in court? I mean, do you have any thoughts on that?
You know, so far, what we've heard is that it's super unlikely for the rules themselves to change. What is more likely is, so I'm looking at the FRE 901 and 902 series, and, you know, which basically says that the evidence produced must be, quote, sufficient to produce, to support a finding that the item is what the proponent claims it is, end quote. You know, in the pre-deepfake era, like circumstantial evidence was often enough to determine the authenticity of something because courts wanted to avoid these lengthy trials, which involved, you know, expensive forensic experts for every step and, you know, like affidavits for every authentication. But I think now the impact might just be that attorneys have to rely on forensic experts more than they have. And, you know, it's just going to be these, again, expensive kind of practices that were shed by courts that are just going to come back. And I think that's just going to impact people who really can't afford trials that go like that. And then, you know, that's who I worry about the most.
So this has been just a fascinating and scary conversation.
Yeah, I guess.
And so... You know, there is a great burden on legal professionals here to educate themselves. So how can they, you know, most effectively educate themselves and sort of stay updated on the latest developments in deepfake technology to, you know, better navigate its impact on litigation and evidence? No easy answer, I'm sure.
Yeah, there's many ways. From my perspective, I'm always like, you know, read the right publications, check out the scholarship that's coming out. And there is some really interesting scholarship coming out about this. Off the top of my head, Rebecca Delfino wrote a great paper about deepfakes in trials. And seek out workshops, seminars.
Talk to your e-discovery people, you know?
Yeah, talk to your e-discovery people. Talk to your IT department.
Read Isha's articles.
Yeah, exactly. all of them, all the time.
And I would also say recruit and hire the right people, you know, whether they're tech experts for like judges' back pockets or for counsel or just in e-discovery departments. I wish there was one answer to that. I would love a single answer, but there isn't, I don't think.
Yeah. Well, you know, we work in an industry that loves looking back at things and what kind of precedent is out there. Yeah. So I know deep fakes are kind of the new rage, but you know, before that there was Photoshop, before that there was, you know, photo manipulation, evidence manipulation. Do you know if there's any legal precedent or if there's landmark cases out there where this type of either deep fake now or what would have been, you know, essentially a deep fake, you know, two years or before that kind of significantly changed the outcome of a case? And are there any lessons that this industry can look back on and kind of apply to what we're approaching?
I'm going to have to think about that. I definitely don't know of any cases like that about deepfakes as the technology we're talking about today.
Yeah.
But when it comes to the past, the only thing that comes to mind, I think, and I don't even know if this directly connects, but I think about, you know, like we've talked a lot about deepfakes in elections and politics, but the place where litigation most is going to come is defamation, in my opinion, and not just in the U.S., but also internationally, which is what we've reported. And sadly, a majority of deepfakes are seen in revenge porn and porn that is using, you know, faces of celebrities in videos. And there was a case that actually struck down, I'm trying to look it up, but it was a federal child pornography law, I believe, that ruled that the First Amendment, you know, protects the graphic manipulation of images even if it appears that, you know, it's minors who are engaging in these activities, because it's not, it's generated, you know, synthetically, and it's not real, and nobody was harmed during the making of it. And I, that's the only thing that comes to mind. How it's going to directly connect to deepfakes, I don't know, except to say that, you know, there's really strong First Amendment protections for defamation. And while litigation might go up, it's really unlikely to kind of succeed, you know, because it's hard to prove. And there's a lot of protection for creativity and parody and for synthetically produced materials. And I think...
And political speech.
And political speech, that's right. So I don't know if that was a bit of a stretch, but that's all that really came to mind.
So, you know, we've talked about more, having more education. We've talked about different types of technology that can perhaps spot deepfakes. What other measures, or are there any other measures that should be taken to, you know, adapt to, you know, deepfake technology that's impacting e-discovery and the overall judicial process? You know, are there any things that need to change? I mean, you know, apparently the rules don't, you know, the experts are saying the rules don't need to change, but, you know, what does?
You know, there's two things. One is really keeping an eye on the AI detection technology that's coming out and incorporating it as quickly as you can. And by you, I mean courts and e-discovery professionals. And the other thing is really, and this is the slower process, but if there was a federal kind of federal statute that would make AI image generation companies watermark their output, that could be another thing that would be super helpful in this fight against deepfakes. But yeah, that's what I think, other than education.
And triple damages.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to say, come down hard on the first one that gets caught. So, So Isha, we're at the point now where we ask all of our guests our crystal ball questions. So we're going to ask you to pull out your crystal ball and peer into the future for us. And so what do you see happening with deepfakes and its effects on the legal system, say, over the next 2 to 5 years?
I'm going to think about this. So I really think that we haven't seen deepfakes affect litigation to a significant extent yet, but the dam is going to break, I think. And you know, courts and counsel and juries and e-discovery professionals, if they're unprepared, I think it has a real risk to the judicial process. That's one prediction. And at the same time, I think that, like data privacy statutes, we are going to see a patchwork of conflicting, but a patchwork nonetheless, of laws that regulate AI-generated images and audio and video. And I also think we will have sophisticated detection software. I really do. But I think that the system is inequitable, and so some courts will have it and some courts won't.
Well, I'll leave it on that. Isha Marate, tech reporter with ALM, thank you very much for taking the time to share your insights on the effects of deepfakes with us.
I had such a good time talking to you guys. Thank you so much for having me.
Me too. And of course, I'm still scared, though.
I know. I hate, like, I always, you know, I always used to watch these, read news articles and be like, oh, I hate the alarmists. But now I fear I sound like
Seems like every day is just another alarm that's going off, so... But thank you for sharing this with us and educating us in this area.
Of course.
And of course, thanks to you, our audience, for taking the time to listen to the Geek & Review podcast. If you enjoy the show, share it with a colleague. We'd love to hear from you, so reach out to us on social media. I can be found at GabeBauerM on Twitter.
And I can be reached at Galambert on Twitter. Isha, if someone wants to reach out to you, where's the best place?
It's also on Twitter, at iMarate, M-A-R-A-T-H-E.
And listeners, you can also leave us a voicemail on our Geek & Review hotline at 713-487-7821. And as always, the music you hear is from Jerry David DeSica. Thank you, Jerry.
Thanks, Jerry. All right, Marlene, happy anniversary.
Thank you. You too.
And happy anniversary, guys.
Don't have to go too far. Salt of the earth on the way to fast.